Lecture 22, Liberating the Greeks of Asia.
Welcome back. You will read in many modern histories about Alexander the Great that he and his father Philip were really initially motivated simply by a desire to reclaim the liberty of those Asiatic Greek cities. This was their motive, and that was all they were trying to do, and that when Alexander crossed the Hellespont at the head of his great army, that he really wasn't looking any further than Ionia, than Western Asia Minor, but that one thing led to another, that success bred success, and he finally found himself willy-nilly in the heart of the Persian Empire. I think nothing could be more naive than this view. And I think it would really please Philip and Alexander to know that their PR machines were still working in the 21st century. After all, it was they who promulgated the idea that this was, in the words of Isocrates the Greek, more a sacred mission than a military expedition. In other words, Isocrates viewed it as a liberation campaign, and that is the label that first Philip and then Alexander put on the expedition to make it palatable to the Greeks. We are fighting to avenge the wrongs that Xerxes did to you when he came into Greece and burned the temples at Athens and at other places, and we are fighting to liberate the Greeks in Asia, those people that had been in and out of Persian domination ever since the time of Cyrus the Great in the mid-6th century BC. But I think if we look at what French historians call the longue durée, the long run of history, look beyond individual events, battles, and personalities, and think, what are the preoccupations of populations, of peoples, of rulers over the long span of history, we can see that right back to 499 BC with Aristagoras and his map of the Persian Empire and his trying to lure the Spartans all the way to Susa, capture the treasure of the Persians and make themselves as rich as Zeus, the idea of Greeks conquering Persia has been a preoccupation. Alexander would have had to have been dead to all kinds of long-standing beliefs and ideas and senses of purpose in Greek politics if this wasn't on his mind. At any rate, when he crossed the Hellespont for the first time, he came in contact with the armies of the great king trying to stop him. Persia had a new great king. His name was Darius III, and I should explain that these names of these 4th century Persian kings are throne names. These are young men who were not born named Artaxerxes or Darius. They were born with other names, not knowing that they were going to grow up to be king. But once the struggles for succession had passed with the death of their predecessor, they would take on a name of one of those earlier Achaemenid conquering monarchs so that they would be seen to be in the line of these great kings who had gone before them. So Darius III is the man on the throne. He was only distantly related to the previous king, and he came to power at the same time as Alexander. He was a bit older than Alexander, but he was a warrior too. He had performed feats of strength in his youth. And he was ruling from Babylon and from Susa, and he was very, very slow to act. He unfortunately inherited not the first Cyrus's beliefs about acting quickly and with speed and seizing the initiative and using your mind against the enemy. He still had Xerxes' mentality about God's on the side of the big battalions. I just need to throw the largest number of people I can, and inevitably we will win. How anyone could go on believing that after a century and a half of rough handling at the hands of these Greeks who used their metis, their cunning intelligence, to turn even great forces' strength and power and massiveness against them in the same way that a judo wrestler will use the weight of his antagonist against the antagonist himself. It's hard to understand, but that's what Darius did. He gave orders for the Western satraps there in Asia Minor to amass a great force of Persian cavalry, and to find a plain on which to deploy it. And he sent some of the flower of Persian nobility up there to join in this effort to stop Alexander. What should they have done? They should have tackled that little preliminary army of Philip that was sent across under Parmenio and Attalus. They had the power to wipe them out if they'd taken that seriously. And then they would have been able to line the shores of the Hellespont and stop Alexander's ships from landing. We all know from D-Day and a thousand other examples that landing a force, an armed force, in an amphibious maneuver is one of the toughest things in all of military science, and that was the place to block Alexander. Now, Darius's best commander was a mercenary, a Greek nobleman from the island of Rhodes. His name was Memnon, and he was one of the great military geniuses of the age. He was serving Darius, and unfortunately, that meant he was a Greek among Persians, and the other Persian nobles and commanders paid him little heed or respect. Memnon pointed out to them that now that Alexander had crossed, their best course was to practice a scorched earth policy, to cut down the fruit trees, burn the crops, strip the countryside of provisions for Alexander and his army, and make it very difficult for them to stay in Persia the longer they remained in the great king's territory. The satrap, who was in charge of that northwest corner of Asia Minor, didn't want to see his revenues take a tumble. And so for this very short-run motive of what will my tribute look like next year, this excellent plan was overruled, and they simply found on the eastern side of the Granicus River, a little stream that ran from Mount Ida, south of Troy, northward into the Sea of Marmara, emptying into the Sea of Marmara not far from Cyzicus, where we saw our great battle between Greeks and Persians, Greeks and Greeks and Persians, back in 409 BC. They found a field, a vast plain, where their allegedly 20,000 cavalry could deploy and planted themselves there, sure that Alexander would come through on his way east. I am not giving you regularly the numbers that are assigned in the ancient sources to both sides. Some people think that Alexander's numbers are being quoted correctly because they seem reasonable, and the Persian numbers are incorrect because it's very unlikely that Darius could really field 600,000 here and 1,000,000 there. I think they're all suspect, and you're certainly welcome to look at the sources and draw your own conclusions, but we need to face the facts. We don't really know, and they may not have known how many people were on the field at any given time. At any rate, just bear in mind, Alexander is numerically outnumbered in all of the three great battles that he is going to have to fight if he wants to win the Persian Empire. The first one is at this Granicus River. Alexander makes his way along with his army already sort of half deployed in battle formation because he does not initially know where he will find the enemy. He just knows that a big force of cavalry and a very small force of mercenary Greek infantry lie somewhere out there ahead to oppose his passing. He comes to the Granicus River and he sees a deep-cut stream, one of those typical Asiatic or Eastern Mediterranean streams, which is filled with turbulent rushing water in the winter from the winter rains and the snow melt in spring, but then dies down in the summer. He's there in late spring, early summer, and he finds there's water in the river. Also, there's a slippery, muddy slope on the far side. This is going to be very tough for his horses. He has his normal arrangement. He's got his infantry with their sarissas in the middle. He has off on the left Parmenio with some of the cavalry, and he has his own cavalry on the right wing. On the other shore, at the top of that bank, he sees the thousands upon thousands of Persian horse, the cavalry of Persia, waiting for him, very mobile, able to flow up and down the stream side and tackle anybody who attempts to come across. And he sees off in the distance, on a little rise, the Greek mercenaries, the formidable hoplite phalanx that's been recruited by the Persians with their gold from all over the Greek world, these soldiers of fortune. Alexander waits till late in the day. I believe he's doing the same thing that Themistocles and Eurybiades did long ago in the battle at Artemisium, that naval battle where the Greeks first tried to stop Xerxes' fleet from getting into Greece. They wait till late in the day. Why? There's only a few hours of daylight left. No matter how badly the battle may go, and just as Artemisian was the first time that the Greeks had tackled the Persian armada, Granicus River is the first time that Alexander has actually come head-to-head with a Persian army. He doesn't really know what will happen. But if you limit the number of daylight hours in which the engagement can occur, you limit the possibilities for a huge disaster for your own army. He sent his infantry down into the ravine. This may have been something that the Persians did not expect. He takes some of his cavalry and puts them in a line in front of the infantry. The men are up on their horses. They have small shields. And since the Persians will be shooting down from their high place on the riverbank, these lines of cavalry can help screen, to some extent, the troops wading through the river, the Granicus River, behind them. The horses splash through the river first. They get to the far side. The Macedonian cavalry are holding up their shields and trying to defend themselves against the barrage of missiles that's coming down. And behind them come the Sarissa wielders, the infantry of Alexander, moving across. Among those first horsemen to cross, that initial crossing of horsemen, the casualties are pretty high. And the Persians, seeing easy pickings and not being as disciplined as Alexander's troops, draw together and focus on what looks to them like the main attempt to get across. Meanwhile, Alexander takes advantage of their focus on his front line and the center to break off, as he so often does, with the right cavalry wing and go upstream. He's in the river too, and it may have been that the current was stronger than he thought, because it took a long time for him to get beyond the last of the Persians, who were all distracted by the action going on in the center. But he finally gets upstream far enough that he can get ashore, get his horses up onto the enemy side of the Granicus River, and now attack them from the flank. Once this happens, the battle is effectively won. The Persians have failed to prevent him from crossing. They could have done it if they'd stuck to their original plan of lining the shore, but they fell into his trap. They focused on the first ones to try to get across. It's like little kids playing a soccer game. It's just all a cloud of dust following the ball. And Alexander gets across. He fights against the cavalry. He's one of those people like Cyrus the Great of the Persians at the very beginning. He fights at the forefront. He risks his own life every step of the way. Now, we saw this go wrong with Prince Cyrus during the Battle of the 10,000 at Cunaxa, where the prince effectively won the battle but lost the war because he got himself killed. But there's a trade-off here, and commanders have to decide what is my goal? Is it to inspire my troops so that they will go on fighting and carrying out this impossible campaign, or is it just to survive? Well, unfortunately, this is a cleft stick of a decision. You got to be lucky. You've got to be lucky and get through those battles, and Alexander was willing to take the risk. In fact, it was in his nature to abhor the idea of standing back, being on his horse on a high place, looking out over the plain and directing his forces from there. He was on the front line. And he was almost killed a couple of times in this Battle of the Granicus River. It said that his spear broke at one point and he was able to fight on with that spear butt spike that we've met before, that bronze point that was on the butt end of the spear shaft. He turned it around and kept on fighting with that. At one point, a Persian was about to aim a killing thrust at Alexander. And next to him was a friend, one of his companions from his youth, a man named Clytus, who cut off the Persian's arm just before the blow fell that would have killed Alexander. So Clytus remembered for the rest of his life, he saved Alexander at the Granicus River. At any rate, after the melee, the fighting, the confusion there at the top of the bank, as the infantry, now with the Persian cavalry distracted, is able to get up the slope themselves and onto the plain, between the hammer of the cavalry and the anvil of those infantry with their big sarissas, the Persians are first crushed and then flee. This brings Alexander up to the place where the Greek infantry, the hoplites, are waiting on their knoll, Darius's mercenary force. And he wades right into them, kills many of them. They try to surrender under terms, which means that, oh, if you'll grant us certain conditions, we'll lay down our arms. He says, no terms. He is outraged to find Greeks fighting against him. He can't understand why they haven't joined this pan-Hellenic crusade, and he takes it personally. Of course, these Greeks, they've never heard of any pan-Hellenic crusade. They've just been earning a living as soldiers of fortune, and now they're up against this insane person, this psychotic commander. And when the battle's over, and he's won, and he's erected his victory trophy, he comes and looks over these prisoners. And he picks out the Athenians among them because they make him madder than anything else, that Athens, which once fought Persia and was the bulwark against Persia, should now have sons fighting against him, opposing the war to conquer Persia. He sends those guys off in something you shouldn't normally do to a prisoner of war, to the mines, the gold mines in Thrace, to work like slaves deep in the tunnels under the mountain and bring up more wealth for him and probably die within a very short time. He also remembers that this war is for revenge on Xerxes. So he takes 300 suits of armor from the Persians that were dead on the field, and he sends them back to Athens. Now, Athens had been filled with mixed feelings about following Alexander. Athens prized its freedom. It had never liked following Sparta. It didn't like following Macedon. But the Athenians had been loyal to Alexander. They sent ships when he asked for them. And in the troubles that lie ahead, he will in fact find behind him uprisings in Greece, Spartans who try to derail the whole effort by reclaiming their hegemony over Greece. The regent he left behind will have to come down as a man named Antipater. We'll have to bring a Macedonian army down and fight in Greece. If it had gotten much worse, Alexander would have had to go home and give up the whole campaign. The thing that saved him was the Athenians did remain loyal to him. They did not mobilize their immense fleet of 400 triremes to fight against Alexander. And so he sends back to the Athenians a gift. A gift of 300 suits of Persian armor with instructions that they are to be dedicated on the Acropolis to the gods, with an inscription saying that Alexander, the son of Philip, and all of the Greeks, except for the Spartans, dedicate these to the god from the spoils of Asia. If you go to the Parthenon today and look up at the east facade, the actual front door, and that's the one that's away from the gate that gets you up onto the Acropolis, you can see the holes where the Persian shields were hung in a long row above the entrance to the Parthenon by the Athenians, and you can see the tiny holes where bronze letters were originally placed with that dedication, Alexander, the son of Philip, and the Greeks, and so on. So there's a desire on Alexander's part to memorialize with these gifts and with these inscriptions this epic undertaking that he has now embarked on. From Granicus River, he heads south. The word of what he achieved there has gone ahead of him. Most of the cities open their gates, cities like Ephesus. When he gets to Sardis, that great former capital of the kingdom of Lydia, that place that has played such a role in our story of Persians and Greeks fighting each other, the Persian governor comes out and meets him on the road with the keys to the citadel. And since Sardis was the provincial capital, that means that a great windfall of treasure has fallen into his lap. This is very welcome. He's got to pay his troops and he's got to buy provisions all the way along. So he's partly fighting, as Alcibiades did once in the Sea of Marmara. He's fighting for the very money, the very wealth that will allow him to continue the campaign. He leaves Macedonians behind him and to garrison these cities and to serve as governors of the cities, but he does pose as a liberator. He tells these cities that they can now choose their own governments. Typically, those are democracies who are pro-Alexander, where the oligarchies, the rule of the few, had been pro-Persian. But it's clear they got to make contributions. And what the exact distinction was that a Greek would have seen between the tribute they used to pay to the great king and the contribution that they now have to give to Alexander is not entirely clear, but it was certainly clear to him, I have liberated you. He met his first real resistance among the Greek cities when he got to Miletus. Now, that was the greatest city of Ionia, and it wants to be neutral now. In this new world order that seems to be emerging, they would like not to be Persian and not to be one of Alexander's little cities that he has a garrison and a governor in. So they have a huge Greek mercenary army inside. Finally, Darius has gotten himself together and taken Memnon's advice to try to stir up trouble at sea and draw Alexander away. So a fleet, I said I wasn't going to give you the numbers, but the claims are it's 400 ships. I don't believe that for a minute, but lots and lots of triremes come up from Phoenicia and Cyprus and Cilicia, and they are planning to stop Alexander at Miletus. What's Alexander's method of opposing fleets that come against him? he occupies every possible port or beach on the mainland where those fleets could land, and they are neutralized. These galleys cannot stay at sea for a long time, for long periods. They have to go off and find an island somewhere to make their base. They initially go to Mycale, that mountain place with a beach below where back in 479 BC, Xanthippus the Athenian and the other Greeks caught and burned Xerxes' fleet while it was ashore, so it was well known to the Persians. They land there, and then from the sea they have to watch helplessly as Alexander brings up his siege engines, storms the walls of Miletus, and captures it. It was an extraordinary scene. The mercenaries inside, fearing what Alexander would do to them, took their shields, put them like little skiffs in Miletus harbor, and tried to paddle away and get out to sea using their hands as oars to propel themselves across the water. So desperate were they to try to escape. But it did not succeed. He rounded them all up and took this greatest city of Ionia. Miletus had attached to it a shrine, an oracular shrine called Didyma, founded by priests from Delphi long, long before, and rivaling Delphi at one time as a great place for prophecies. And people from all over the Eastern Greek world would come to Didyma near Miletus and ask for prophecies from the priestess who spoke for Apollo there. But then in the time of the First Persian Wars, Darius and Xerxes, the Persians had burned the temple, and the spring, the sacred spring that brought the gases to the surface, dried up. And it had been dry for 150 years. But when Alexander approached, the water started bubbling up again from the rock. And the priest sent a message to Alexander, thanking him for restoring the force of nature, letting the god speak again, and assuring Alexander that the god had indeed foretold Alexander would meet success in his mission in Asia. Alexander was very happy with this. He gave them some money to rebuild the temple. He also tried to rebuild that temple in Ephesus. And they said to him, these Greeks in Ephesus, whose temple of Artemis had fallen and been burned, you know, it's not right for one god to build a temple for another god. Not clear why they wouldn't take the money, but they did not want to. And so he had to pass on, having failed to carry his point there. Nonetheless, he was trying to wrap his progress in this cloak of religiosity, of divinity, of oracles, portents, contacts with the gods, services to the gods, all the way south through Ionia and the rest of the Greek cities. Beyond Miletus, he got into hill country. He's now in the district called Caria. And Caria was a place traditionally where there were strong female rulers, a real anomaly in the Mediterranean world. If you think back to Artemisia, that queen of Halicarnassus who was the admiral of her little contingent in Xerxes' grand armada at Salamis back in 480 BC, she was one of these Carian queens. There's one living now up in the hills. Her name is Ada. And she and Alexander meet. She's an older woman. He seems to have had a mother fixation and was always pleased to be in the company of older women, and they liked him, and he hit it off with Ada, and they joined forces to tackle the next big city in Alexander's path, Halicarnassus, Herodotus' hometown, a Dorian city sitting at the southwest corner of Asia Minor, which was very heavily fortified by double walls to protect the city on the landward side and by a great circular fortified harbor, one of the best harbors in all the Mediterranean, facing the sea. And there, Memnon of Rhodes had brought the Persian fleet, intending to hold out there. And there was an Athenian mercenary in charge of the defense of the city who was a descendant of that same Ephialtes, and actually bore the name Ephialtes, the Ephialtes who back in the time of Pericles had started the great dramatic democratic revolution in Athens. And Ephialtes, that first one, had been a naval commander attacking the Persian Empire. Now his descendant, certainly his namesake, is in charge of the garrison at Halicarnassus. Alexander needs those siege engines again. He's tired of the fleet, the Greek fleet, that has been with him so far. They haven't done much. He doesn't like ships. After all, there aren't any sea battles in the Iliad, so it doesn't seem part of his nature to collaborate with ships. He had turned down the proposals of his own generals to use his fleet as a real naval arm of the expedition. So he sends them all home. He keeps the 20 Athenian triremes for one last purpose. He loads onto their decks the gigantic siege equipment, these battering rams, and there may have been catapults also. And they take them to a beach on the north side of the peninsula, where Halicarnassus is on the south side, and there's a fairly level road for him to tow the siege equipment from the beach over to Halicarnassus. Once he's rendezvoused with those ships, he tells them to hang around and wait till the siege is over. And then in late summer, he hauls the siege equipment over the hills to Halicarnassus and starts to attack. He can look down into the beautiful circular harbor. He can see the hundreds of Persian ships there holed up within that fortified port. But he is kept at bay for a long time by that double ring of walls, by very effective defensive measures on the part of Ephialtes and Memnon. And he's getting very frustrated. We have to remember that he lives at a period when the defensive cities had reached a higher art than the offensive machinery to bring down the walls or sap them. Alexander tries everything. Having finally broken through the outer defenses, he simply finds that the defenders go within the next ring of walls, and he's got to do the whole thing all over again. Finally, they break through in a very funny way. There's a small night guard in the Macedonian army who get bored with night duty and dare each other to go tackle a certain tower in the offensive lineup. They rush in, alarms are sounded, fires are lit, all the Greeks wake up and realize what's happened, the Greeks and the Macedonians, and they rush forward to help their friends, and in rushing forward, they actually stage a charge that captures the walls, and Halicarnassus falls. Memnon sees what is happening and slips out with his ships before Alexander can get down to the port. So Persian sea power is still intact, but the city of Halicarnassus, the old hometown of Herodotus the historian, is now in Alexander's hands, and he has now completed that run down the coast of Asia Minor that has, quote unquote, liberated all of those Greek cities from Persian rule. The dream that had been born back in the 6th century when Cyrus took them over has now finally been brought to pass. Alexander then turns east, goes along the shore of Asia Minor. He sends some of his troops inland. The Athenian triremes carry the siege engines to a place on the Maeander River, and then those ships go home. Alexander is right along the coast. You're not supposed to go on the coast. There are royal roads inland for carrying traffic, but he likes to attempt the impossible. He gets to a place where the cliff comes right out into the sea. There's no road at all. He and his soldiers strip down, carry their armor on their heads, and wade in the sea to get around this obstacle and keep going. Last, they come back to the road near Antalya that carries them up into the heartland of Asia Minor. They meet Parmenio, who's followed the royal road from Sardis. And together, they all go to this ancient city of Gordion. Now, Gordion is the place where King Midas, he of the golden touch, was once the ruler, that mythical figure who was actually a very wealthy ruler and whose tomb has recently been discovered. And there was at Gordion an object that was very famous. It was called the Gordian knot. And it was bark from a tree that had been twisted together into this sort of bowling ball-sized object where you could see lots of straps and pieces of the bark, no clear ends. It held a span for a team of oxen to the yoke. And it was said that whoever could figure out how to untie that knot would be the ruler of all Asia. Well, this was not a challenge that Alexander could pass up. So after the local priest had explained it to him, this object was kept in one of the temples, he went there and he looked over the Gordian knot. And after he'd studied it for a while, he just pulled out of the scabbard his sword and sliced right through it. And once he did that, it was seen that the whole thing had been a trick. It was not a single strand of that bark in a rope that really had a way to unknot it. There were many different pieces, all their ends met together, hidden in the middle of the ball. The only way to get through it was violence, a single blow or slice to cut that knot. At any rate, having received the blessing of the god Apollo at Didyma, having performed this wonderful feat at Gordion, Alexander felt more than ever that he was fulfilling prophecies, that he was indeed the man chosen by destiny to wrest Asia away from the Persians. He had still not met Darius himself, his chief antagonist, but in a short time, these two kings would come face to face on a battlefield at Issos, and it will be the task of our next lecture to follow them there.